because they're the same.
Yeah. Well, I've always said that. I said that to be where I
Okay, the second half here, we're going to learn how to build a rain garden. We're very fortunate to have David Hilgers with Triad with us today. And just as a little word of warning, this one's going to be filmed so that we can show it again and on our TV stations and stuff like that. So you'll see the cameras moving around. That's why David's wired for sound. If you have questions, please speak up pretty loudly so we can pick those up. And maybe if you could repeat the question too.
Sure. Okay.
So without further ado, here's David on rain gardens.
All right. I want to thank everybody for coming. I'm David Hilgers, as you mentioned. I'm a landscape architect with Triad Associates. We're a Kirkland company. We're land development consultants. We provide engineering, planning, landscape architecture, and survey. We've been here in Kirkland for about 30 years, so we've kind of a local company that is, likes to give back to the community here, and this is just part of our public outreach here is this presentation today. So I'm going to talk about how to build a rain garden, but I'm also going to talk a little bit broad picture at the beginning about what a rain garden is, what the benefits are for it, briefly, and also talk about how it fits into kind of a broader range of stormwater management techniques called low impact development. So low impact development is a rainwater management technique, a stormwater management technique, that involves many different techniques to manage the stormwater on site. The goal of it is, goal of any stormwater management is to slow it down and clean it up. So we have slowing it down, which helps with some erosion problems when the water tends to heat up and goes over hard surfaces. It gets fast, it starts to erode, it heats up as well. All this causes problems downstream to our fish and salmon and any other mammals or animals living in the stream or water bodies. Low impact development has many different techniques. Bioretention is a fancy word for rain gardens. Bioretention basically is using soil and vegetation to help manage stormwater, trying to mimic nature. When you have a natural area that's undeveloped, that stormwater that hits that area is being managed by nature itself. The trees, the soil, it all helps to slow that rainwater down. It doesn't concentrate it into one area and start eroding. It really does a great job of managing stormwater on its own. So when we come and clear that vegetation and soil layer and put down hardscape and buildings and structures, we now have a situation where the nature can't manage that stormwater, so we have to try to attempt to mimic that using low-impact development techniques. Another technique in low-impact development is compost-amended soils. And that's basically taking compost and amending those soils on the site and creating a thick layer of compost and organic matter in there that can help slow down that water and clean it up as well. We also have permeable paving, which is permeable concrete, permeable asphalt, pavers. All of those work well to allow the water, instead of flowing over the top, to infiltrate down through. Vegetated roofs or green roofs are another method. Minimal excavation foundations, which are basically just pin foundations. Instead of digging a full foundation, you dig particular areas and you drill down in, and that helps hold up your home. And then also rainwater harvesting. So all these are techniques in low-impact development. Low-impact development works better when in conjunction with all of these techniques together or using several of them on a site. Doesn't really function as well on more of a commercial application or a retail application if you just try to use one technique. It's all good. Using anything is great, but using them in combination works better. So you can see this illustration shows some porous paving, some bioswales, and as the water flows through there, it gets to the rain garden. On the other side, we have 8 to 12 inches of amended compost amended soil. So all these working together can help eliminate like a detention pond or a stormwater vault. They typically could help reduce that footprint of the pond or the detention vault. So now we know a little bit about low impact development and how rain gardens fit within that. We'll talk about what is a rain garden. So a rain garden is simply just a depression where rainwater can flow and collect and infiltrate into the ground. It tries to imitate nature by using vegetation and soil, as we mentioned before. And also, the goal of stormwater management is to slow it down and clean it up, as I mentioned, so we have water quality and flow. So the benefits to a rain garden. They help reduce flooding and control erosion. So we're concentrating it into an area where we're trying to infiltrate. We're not trying to flow it into a concentrated area like a catch basin where it all comes to one point, goes subsurface into a pipe, and it's gone. We help reduce the combined sewer system overflow. So many municipalities, Seattle being one of those, you have a stormwater system, you have a sewer system. Well, sometimes in the old days, they combined those into one. So you have stormwater that goes flowing in, we have a major storm, it starts to overwhelm that system and we get backups and flooding. Well, when you have a combined system with sewer and stormwater in the same, you can kind of imagine the problems when we have backups and flooding. So that doesn't happen. I'm not sure if Kirkland has a lot of areas of that, but it also helps reduce the amount of water that the stormwater system for a municipality has to manage. So if you're reducing that, if you disconnect your downspout and do a rain garden where it's managing it on site and not kicking it down to the stormwater system into a catch basin, you've just reduced the amount of water that that municipality has to manage. We also have pollution filtration. So the vegetation and the soil, they do most of the work for filtering pollutants. Pollutants could be metals, toxics from cars, runoffs from petroleum-based fuels. We also have chemical pollutants. If you fertilize your lawn or something and those chemicals get washed away, those pollutants are in that water as well. Can really damage the downstream water quality for fish and other animals living in that water. We also have a potential for the increase of groundwater. It doesn't always happen that way. It depends on how the subsurface flow of the water is working. But we have a potential to increase the groundwater aquifer recharge. We also provide localized habitat for birds and insects. So if you create a little rain garden on your area, and you've just basically created a native area where now animals and insects and birds can now thrive and live and have a place to hang out. So what are the main components of a rain garden? Now I'm making this very simple because they really are fairly simple. Number one, we have water storage in depth. Typically 6 to 12 inches depth. You don't want a large depth in a rain garden. You want to keep that very shallow. One of the reasons for that is this is trying to infiltrate, so you need a wider body of area. You don't want a lot of depth because that infiltration has to happen fairly quickly, and we don't want water standing in there for long periods of time. We have composted soil. That's typically 12 to 24 inches of depth. This is really where the workhorse is happening, where the vegetation gets its nutrients to grow, where the pollutant filtration is happening, where stormwater storage is happening. It's all in the composted layer. We have an overflow pipe. We're trying to infiltrate. That's the goal. But as we've seen, nature can kind of throw you a curveball, and it can really overwhelm your rain garden, no matter how well it's designed. So you really need an overflow to help take that water that overwhelms the rain garden and pipe it away and take it down the system. Number four is vegetation. Also with the soil, kind of one of the major workhorses of the rain garden to help slow down the water, infiltrate, and clean it up. So now we know a little about rain gardens. We know a little bit about low impact development. So we're ready to build one. So here we go. We'll learn about how to build one in our own lot, our own residence. There's four major steps to this. We have planning and location. This is where you need to kind of look at your site, evaluate your site. Is it adequate for a rain garden? Does it really work within your site? Not all sites are going to be able to accommodate a rain garden. And then location, looking at where on your site is going to work. We have design and construction. This is where you really start to look at, okay, how big is this going to be? How deep does this need to be? How am I getting my water to that rain garden? And construction, when you get all your planning done, you're ready to go, start building. Then we have planting. And we'll talk a little bit about planting. We have several different zones in a rain garden. There's some areas where we have lots of water holding it all the time. And we also have areas where it's going to be fairly dry. So we have different kind of plants that are needed for that. And then we have maintenance. Got to maintain these things. You know, just like anything in your garden, in your home, you really need to maintain it to keep it aesthetically looking nice and functioning. So planning and location. Slope considerations. This is kind of, we're going to go through some things here where we talk about looking at your site, evaluating it, and making sure it's adequate for a rain garden. So these are some of the main points we need to look at. slope considerations. You don't want to put it within 50 foot of a steep slope. And a steep slope in this case is defined as 15% or less. And to kind of get a visual on that, a 10% slope is about an 8-degree slope. And I don't know if your mind works better in degrees versus percentages. Mine typically does. So if you think about like a really steep roadway, most municipalities, 10% slope is kind of a max roadway slope. So you can kind of picture going up a road that's a municipal road, not a mountain road. And also 8 degrees is right around a 10%. So you can think about maybe 10 degrees to 12 degrees would be a 15% slope. So it's not very much. And then we have setback from structures. You don't want to put it within 10 feet of a building. Your crawl space is a concern. Your basement, if you have a basement, that's a concern. We want to keep that away from that. We have septic and utilities. You really know where your utilities are. Call for a locate before you get going on this. Make sure you know where your power is, your gas line is. All these utilities, very important before you start digging. Also looking at if you have a septic tank and a drain field on your site, make sure you look at that and know where that is and how that functions. And don't put it within 50 feet of a septic drain field. So we have soil and infiltration. You need to look at the soil on your site. We're going to talk more about this in a bit. You need to test your soil so you know how good it infiltrates and how what type of soil you have on your site. Groundwater, we'll talk a little bit about that as well when we get into the soil testing. And you don't want to put it within where you have a really high groundwater table. The rule right now is don't put a rain garden where the water table is 1 foot from the bottom of your rain garden. So you might have to do some calculations to say, well, I have a 30-inch deep rain garden. I've dug down 30 inches, and now I dig another foot, and we have water seeping up into there. So that's kind of a way to see that and know what that really means. And then native areas. If your site is already healthy and native and you have vegetation growing on there and you see that it's a healthy ecosystem of vegetation, maybe it's already functioning great now. So really consider that before you start clearing anything and putting in a rain garden. So drainage area. What is draining to the rain garden? So we need to look at all these different things as options to drain to your rain garden. Pretty much any impervious surface, which is just a surface that rainwater cannot penetrate, can be brought to a rain garden. So we have roof runoff, which is a real common way to treat water. It's nice clean water. It's hit the roof, and it's going down your downspout, and it's a good source of water to treat for a rain garden. Driveways and walkways, those are good common areas to build a rain garden adjacent to it. Patios and compacted areas. Any compacted area, if you know you have your lawn, it's just so compacted that water just doesn't seep down. You know, that might be a factor of your soil type, and we'll get into that in a little bit, but that might be an option for a rain garden to flow down into that. And then again, any impervious surface is an option for your rain garden. So soil type. Does your site soil drain? So these, I don't know if you can see these very well, but these are three different types of soil, kind of a generalized look at them. On my left here, with my back turned, the sand, it's a sand-based soil, it's very granular, it drains very fast. It can be good, and it also can be bad. It's good for a rain garden because you're gonna have high infiltration rate, where water's just gonna go in there and it's gonna dissipate quickly. But it also can cause some problems with water quality. If you know you have a very high pollutant generating surface that you're treating the water from, well, sometimes that water can flow so quickly that it gets down into the groundwater system with those pollutants in it. So you have to kind of take that into consideration with sand. Good, healthy soil in the middle. This is basically compost amended type soil. It has a rich, deep hue to it. It grows plants very well. Worms are in there and living, doing well. High organic matter. That's good soil for a rain garden because it infiltrates well, but it also holds water. And then we have clay-based soil on my right over here, and that's just poor soil. It doesn't drain very well. The water can't perk through it. It's if you grab it and it's moist, you can form it into shapes, and it's clay, basically, and it just doesn't work well for infiltration. If you dig down and find that your soil is clay, you can keep going and see how far you don't go too far, but you can keep going and see if you break through that clay layer and you find some different type of soil underneath there, that might be an option. And then we'll show you an infiltration test here in a minute. You can see how you can test your soil and see if it really works. So here is the infiltration test. Basically, you're going to go on your site and you're going to dig a hole. We're going to dig a hole about 12 inches to 20 inches in diameter and roughly about 24 inches deep. And you want to take this hole and fill it with 8 inches of water. And then you want to time how long it takes that water to dissipate. You really need to think about the time of year you're doing this. If you do it in the summer, it hasn't rained in a month, you're going to have that water just going to go away very quickly. So you need to consider that and do the test 3 times if you're doing it in the summer and use the results of the 3rd test as your results of infiltration rate. If it's winter or fall, and fall, this is a great time right now because the soil's moist, we've had some rains, but it's not completely saturated. So it's a good indication of your soil infiltration rate. So you fill that with 8 inches of water. You time how long it takes for it to dissipate. In this case, if you have 8 inches and it takes 12 hours, on the bottom right here we have some numbers, that's 0.67 inches per hour. So this kind of take that number and look at the chart up here on the top right. If you have less than 0.5 inches per hour of infiltration, your soil is poor draining. If you have more, your soil is well draining. So that's just an easy way to kind of put a barometer into what your soil is. And then the poor draining and well draining are terms that are used further when we start looking at sizing. And you know, I forgot to mention at the beginning, I'm basing my presentation here on this manual. And this is the Rainwater Manual Handbook for Western Washington Homeowners. This is a free download from Washington State University, Pierce County Extension. My last slide will have that link if you want it. I also will send a free version of this, which will have the link, a PDF version of it. There's a sign-up sheet in the back. Sign up, give me your email, and I'll send you a PDF of this particular presentation. But I wanted to pass a couple of these out, let you guys take a look at them. Over there. All right. This really kind of walks you through everything I'm talking about here today. So it's a great resource. And really, it's kind of the Bible right now for rain gardens for single-family residences. There's another Bible you can use if you're doing a development, the Low Impact Development Manual, that also Pierce County Extension of Washington State University put out. So I have a couple other copies. I have a couple here, and I have a couple more over here. So if anybody wants these, first come, first grab after the presentation's over. So that the terminology with poor draining, well draining is also in here. And when we get a little further along and start sizing this rain garden, you're going to see where those terms kind of come into play. So does everybody understand what we did here and how we tested our soil? Yeah?
Typically take 12 to 16 hours for the 8 inches to go away, so you should do it like first thing in the morning.
That's right. Actually, that is, if your soil is poor draining and you have till or you just know you have clay, yeah, I would advise doing it in the morning because it's going to take some time. If you know your soil drains well, you know, you might be able to stand right there and watch it. But yeah, that's a good point. Do this in the morning, preferably on a day it's not pouring down rain at the time. Okay, so we've gone through all of our filters and see if our site is really going to work. And I know it kind of seems like there's a lot of filters. So it can be kind of discouraging. You might find your site just doesn't have the ability to support a rain garden. You're like, geez, you know, I really wanted to do this. I wanted to do something for the environment. There's plenty of other things you can do for the environment. A rain garden isn't just that. Some of the techniques that Lisa was talking about earlier, you know, there's quite a bit. If you go onto that Pierce County Extension website, there's all kinds of techniques you can use there for sustainable gardens, sustainability within your landscape. So if you can't do a rain garden, don't get too discouraged. There's other ways that you can approach this issue of sustainability on your site. So sizing the rain garden, a couple things to consider. How much area is draining to your rain garden? Are you going to take your roof? Are you going to take your driveway? Are you going to take your patios? Are all those going? Are all of them going? So you need to look at what that area is. How much space is available for your rain garden? So if you have a limited space on your lot, one thing to consider is you don't need to do it in all one rain garden. You can split it up and do a couple of them around your lot. So as you can see in this example over here, we have a rain garden over in the lower right corner, and the runoff from the downspouts will go to that. And then they have another one up in the upper right, and they split it up into a couple different. And then we have another one up in front. And then the last thing to look at is how much can the rain garden hold? So typically what happens is you measure the area that's going to go to the rain garden, and you're like, okay, well, this is going to go there. And now you're thinking, well, geez, can this rain garden hold all the rain that's coming from there? Well, that's usually not the limiting factor. Usually the limiting factor is space on your site. So it's better to kind of look at your site and say, okay, after I know here's my utilities, I can't put it there. Here's this slope over here, I can't put it there. So this is really the only area I can put it. So it's only 100 square feet. So that kind of is your limiting factor now. You say, I can only do 100 square feet. So you need to kind of consider that before you go into sizing it for the entire driveway or roof area that you're thinking about bringing to that rain garden. So the best thing to kind of look at this, and this is where it kind of gets a little confusing on sizing, so I wanted to do an example and then ask some questions, make sure you guys understand before we go any further. So in this example, and this is in this manual here, this is the exact one that's in the manual, so if you download that, you can take a look at it and kind of fully understand it if we don't get it here today, but I think we will. So in this example, we have a driveway that's 15 feet by 30 feet, 450 square feet. He's going to take half of the roof to the rain garden. So we have this half on the left, and that's 15 feet by 20 feet and 20 feet by 40 feet. So we have a total of 1,150 square feet of area that we're going to drain to this rain garden. So on the top 1, 2, 3 up here, we know we have 1,150 square feet of impervious area, roofs, driveways, going to the rain garden. We know we've done our soil test, and in this example, we found that we have poor draining soil, so it's less than 0.5 inches per hour of infiltration rate. And for this example, we've looked at the site, and we see we have about 250 square feet as available space for the rain garden. So, now before I get to this stuff down below, I want to jump to this chart. So these are the three things we know: 1,150 square feet coming to the rain garden, poor draining soil, and 250 square feet available. And this is where we get tripped up most of the time. This chart is showing on the first column is percentages of your rain garden area based on the impervious area you're bringing to it. So if you have 1,000 square feet going to the rain garden, 10% of that would be 100 square feet. And in this chart it says if you have a 10% size of your impervious area, it can handle 70% of the volume of water going to the rain garden in poor draining soils, which is the middle column, or it can handle 99% of that water going to the rain garden on well-draining soils. So it's all based on a percentage of the impervious area going to the rain garden. And I don't know why they chose an example with 1,150 square feet. They should have just said 1,000. It's a lot easier. But basically what that means, if you have 1,000 square feet and you want to do a 10% of that size, it's 100 square feet. That means it can handle only 70% of the water that you're bringing to it. If you have well-draining soil, it can handle 99% of the water you're bringing to it. So you can see where the overflow comes into play there, where even on an everyday basis, you might need that overflow. If you size it up, if you go up to 20%, so if you have 1,000 square feet and you do it, or 2,000 square feet and you do a 200 square foot rain garden, or excuse me, now I'm getting screwed up. See, this is confusing. 1,000 square feet, 200 square foot rain garden, that's 20%. Now you can handle 90% of the water on poor draining soils and 100% on well draining soils. So this is kind of where it gets a little confusing. I want to make sure that we understood this chart before I move forward. Does everybody kind of grasp what we're talking? Okay, good. Well, good. Now I'm going to confuse you. So there's there's another relationship based on this. It's area and depth. You can go deeper in your rain garden. When we talked about the depth before, this chart is for a 12 inches of rain garden soil, so down at the bottom you have 12 inches of composted soil, and a 6-inch water holding capacity, depth. So you can go deeper than that. So that's a total of 18 inches. So this chart shows that. If you decide to go to 30 inches, which basically bumps your soil layer to 24 inches and leaves your storage at 6, your water storage, that means you can take this and reduce the square foot area by 5% and still get these same numbers over on the right. So it's kind of confusing, but if you read this manual a little bit more, I think you'll kind of start to understand that. Is there any questions on that, though? Okay, good. So we'll go back to this. So now in our example, we had 250 square feet of available space. So using that table, 20% of the 1,150 was 230 square feet. So that's an 18-inch rain garden. It can handle 90%. And then we have 218 square feet if we went to 30 inches depth. So that's where that depth relationship comes into play. Okay, so that's how you size your rain garden. You kind of have to back into those calculations a little bit and know what your available space. I think that usually is the limiting factor. So that's kind of one of the first things I tell people is, you know, you've done all this work up front, but just make sure you have the room to do the rain garden. Because 250 square feet is not small. I mean, that's pretty big. So, okay, some other design considerations. We have shape. You know your size, but it may not be all that attractive just to build the big square rain garden in your house or in your site. So you might want to look at doing it naturalistic versus geometrical. You know, your site might have a very geometric look and very straight lines, and that plays with that design. So you might want to do that. But stay close to the determined square footage. So if you've done 200 square feet, you know it needs to be that to handle the volume of water. Make sure you stay close to that. Water delivery method. Your rain garden doesn't necessarily have to be right next to your source. You can convey that water to your rain garden, subsurface pipe or swale. Slope. Make sure if you do have a slope on your site, if it's more than 5%, that can get difficult because the bottom of your rain garden wants to be flat. You want to keep it flat. You don't want slope in your rain garden because you want things to infiltrate. You don't want it to start running. So make sure you dig that flat. You might have a taller uphill and a really short downhill. You may need to berm on the downhill side. And the manual kind of explains that a little bit more as well. We need access for maintenance. If you are going to build this thing, you want to make sure you can maintain it. Don't put it somewhere where you can't get to it. You probably don't need like vehicular access or anything, maybe just for construction to bring in soil. But for maintenance, you don't need a vehicular access. And then existing utilities, I say that again because I just want to make sure you know where your utilities are before you start digging. So construction process. We're going to talk about laying it out, excavating, construct the delivery system, so convey that water to your rain garden, the overflow location, your soil mix and placement, which is very important, and planting. So the construction process. You want to lay this out. You know your size. You know the shape now that you're going to make it. So a couple methods of doing that is upside down spray paint works really well. You can paint that on. If you don't like it, you can scrape it out, paint another one. Also, using a garden hose, you can just kind of lay that down on the ground, get your shape, and that works really well for curves and making things that look nice. It's hard to spray paint a nice, good curve. So excavation. Make sure before you start excavating, you've made confident design decisions. You've run your numbers, you've punched those numbers a couple times, you're confident in them. Nothing worse than start digging and find out that something's wrong and you need to go back and do it over. So that's just some advice from someone who's done it wrong a couple times. compaction considerations. When you are doing the excavation, if you're going to use machinery, keep that machinery out of the bottom of the rain garden. You don't want to put it down in the rain garden. You then can compact your subsoils, and that could change your infiltration rate. So that's a big consideration. Don't put machinery in the bottom of the rain garden. So slope considerations, again, what we talked about in slope, you want to keep that bottom flat. One way to do that when you're doing it on your field, if it's your own project, just take a long 2x4, put it down on the bottom, and put a level on top of that, and you can kind of get a good idea if it's flat or not. And you need to take a little bit out over here or add a little bit over here to make that flat. So getting water to the rain garden. Here's a couple photos of different ways to do that. The bottom one on the right is not a way to do that. I'll talk about that in a minute. The surface water runoff, if you have a downspout that's just going to daylight right at the base of your home, you can have a dry riverbed that can swale that to your rain garden. You can do it subsurface, as in this picture here, with the pipes that bringing it to a rain garden. If you have some slope on your site, that works really well. You can daylight it out to the rain garden if you do have that slope on your site. And you need to be consideration of erosion at both the delivery point of your water, where it ends up dissipating into your rain garden, and also your overflow point. If you're just going to use a swale for the overflow point, where the water's just going to go up to a point and have like just a channel that it's going to flow out of, you need to look at erosion. You might want to do some dry riverbed and put some riprap rock right in that area or a splash block or something to make sure we don't have real erosion happening right at the base of your rain garden or at the point of delivery and the point of exit. And then the slope of conveyance, if you're going to convey water, make sure there's some slope. Again, use that level in the 2x4 to make sure you do have some downhill slope for that water to get to your rain garden. So the construction process, the overflow considerations. What happens sometimes is you might design this thing great, but we've had 3 rains in a row, 4 days of rain in the winter. The soil is very saturated, and then we get a storm. And bam, everything just floods. So if your overflow isn't there, you can have a lot of flooding in your rain garden that kind of brings it up and goes out. And depending on where that's located, that can cause some problems. So allow for a safe way for the water, the excess water, to escape. And some examples we have here, this one in a parking lot, the catch basin in the middle in the upper right picture is just set higher. So the water ponds up, and when it gets to that point, it just flows right into that catch basin. So that can be done with just a simple plastic one in your rain garden as well. So that's one method that you can do that. We have this one down over here that just has a pipe overflow. So the entrance of the water is the top right, and the exit is down here. And then in my illustration here, we've just done a simple cap drain on top of a PVC pipe that's stuck up out of the ground. So very simple, but it works. Soil and backfill. So you just excavated all the soil from your rain garden. You've tested your on-site soil. It's not clay, so you don't have to completely remove it. If it is clay, you can't use this in the rain garden. You have to get rid of it. But if it's good soil or fairly good soil, you can reuse this in your rain garden base. The only thing you need to do is augment it with compost. So we have a 65% excavated soil and 35% compost by volume to be brought back in to your rain garden. So an easy way to do that is just 2 scoops from a shovel of your native soil and 1 scoop of compost. Mix that together, make sure it's nice and mixed, and put that down in your bottom of your rain garden. Or you can import soil. If you don't have good soil, you can import some. We have a 60% screen sand and 40% compost mix that works really well. You can get a 60-40 mix like that at pretty much any soil distributor around here, so it's not hard to find. And compost, Cedar Grove is a good source. You can get it down at Home Depot in the bags, depending on how much volume you need. Then placement depth and compaction concerns. Again, just looking at, don't bring machinery down in the bottom of the rain garden. Do that by hand. And try not to compact the soils down there. You can fill it with a machine, you just leave it on the top and it scoops and brings it in there. Planting the rain garden. So you've done all the hard work, now comes the fun part, you get to plant it. So there's several zones. We have 3 zones to look at. We have one at the very bottom that's going to be saturated most of the time, it's going to be wet, and those plants need to be able to handle wet conditions, sometimes called emergent plants because they grow up out of water. And then we'll have an area in between the top and the bottom that's kind of a convergence zone there where it's going to be wet sometimes, it's going to be dry sometimes. So those plants need to be able to handle the variable conditions of moisture. And then we have the top of the rain garden that's going to be dry most of the time. And I'll have another slide here in a minute that'll talk a little bit more about that. There is sample plant lists available. I'm not going to get into how many plants and what plants there are because there's just so many. But this manual has some really great information in the back where we have plant lists that just give you all the information you need and the different plant materials. It doesn't tell you where to buy them, but most nurseries around here will do that. And you'll see a very heavy native plant palette in here. If it's not a native plant, it's a plant that's kind of semi-native. An introduced native is what I like to call them. And then mulching. 3 inches of depth on the sides and the bottom after planting is good. Don't use bark or wood chips in the bottom, because those will float and they'll come up and then they'll spill all over the place. So try to use compost. So this is just an illustration showing the zones that we talked about. Zone 1 being the saturated zone. Zone 2, which is fairly small because it's kind of pinched in this case. And that also depends on the slopes of your sides. If you have a real steep slope, that middle zone can be almost non-existent. If you have a more broad slope, it can be wider. But then you can see some of the plant list is on the left for those particular zones. That's also in the book here. There's 3 or 4 different examples of these ones, like a native one or a sunny and wild condition that this is called. And then we have one that's in the shade. So it gives you different plants for all those conditions. It's very helpful. So maintaining the rain garden. The main issues we have is you do need to water this for establishment. So depending on the time of year, that kind of can fluctuate the amount of water you're going to need. Like if you did it right now, it's a great time because you put those plants in the ground, we get supplemental water from rain. You don't need a lot of irrigation. Also great because the plants can get some roots established before winter hits. So it's just a good time for planting. I mean, fall has always been a good time for planting. But you do need to water those probably the first couple years. And then if you use the right plants, they should take hold and they probably won't need much irrigation from that point on. But I'm kind of a firm believer, even in Seattle, you need to irrigate in the summer if you want your plants to live, depending on what those plants are. If they're native plants and they can go dormant, they'll be fine. But if you introduce some ornamental plants, you're probably going to need water in the summer to keep those living. We get a lot of rain, but as we know in the summer, we get long stretches of drought that we just don't get any water. So you need to, you can probably go out there with a hose and just hit those plants really quick, and that's all you'll need. But you just kind of keep an eye on those and make sure. We don't want the vegetation to die because it's really a crucial functioning part of the rain garden. So mulching, just check the mulch depth, make sure it's there and even and present. Weeding, cleaning. It's not such a big deal if we get some weeds in there. It's more of an aesthetic thing. The weeds can actually function just as good as the ornamental plants and the native plants that you put in there. But it's more of a kind of an aesthetic thing, and if you don't want it just to turn into canary reed grass, which is a real common grass you see around here, you need to weed it. And then cleaning it, this picture kind of shows, this is a rain garden in Portland, where they filled it with water in a test, and then they just skimmed all the debris off the top. But you need to go down in there and pick any debris in there and make sure that your inflow and your outflow are free of any clogs. So those are really important. Just go in there, if you got some clogged pipe or something, scoop that stuff out of there so we have free flowing water. And then pruning, if you use any larger plant material, get in there and prune it, make sure it doesn't get too crazy in there so you can get into the rain garden and maintain it. Other considerations is don't use any fertilizer. You want to keep this organic. You don't want that water that's going to infiltrate in the groundwater to be contaminated with any chemicals. And then check the drainage channels as I talked about. Make sure that we don't have any clogging in the overflow or the conveyance system. And erosion and sediment. If you do see that your conveyance system is causing erosion, you need to kind of evaluate that. Make sure that it is functioning the way you want it to, because we don't want erosion. We want it to come into the rain garden in a nice, smooth manner that doesn't cause real erosion right at the source. And that's it. This is the link that I was talking about to Washington State University, and I am a Coug, so I'm all over promoting that. So I think this is a great website for just any knowledge. If you don't have any knowledge at all about low-impact development, this is a great opening source to just kind of go there and learn some things about it. So I would recommend anybody who's interested to go check that out. All right.
How do we find an installer, David?
Find an installer. You know, I would say that most landscape contractors are familiar with what this is. If you're not comfortable, I would first of all just ask a landscape contractor if you've done one before. If they haven't, give them the manual. Tell them to read this and come back after they've done one. But I think that most landscape contractors will have a good grasp of how we can do this, because it really isn't rocket science. It's pretty simplistic. It's just a matter of following the methods that are laid out in there and following them closely.
Is there one we can see here?
Yeah, I believe. Isn't there one right down here at the new park?
We're going to be trying to put one in by the Forbes House at Juanita Beach Park. It's the area of the park on the north side of Juanita Drive down there.
Yeah.
And hopefully excavation. I just ordered all the soil and compost and everything on Friday, so that should be. They're going to do excavation hopefully on Wednesday.
Okay.
And get the soil in, and then hopefully October 18th. We're going to ask for volunteers to come in and install the plant.
Yep. There's a flyer about that right on the table out there if you're interested in volunteering.
In the packet.
It should be in your packet.
So if you want to help with it, that'd be great. Or if you just want to walk by and see one, it's going to be in the park.
And there are some other locations of rain gardens. One of the more popular ones is the Seattle Sea Streets. Mm-hmm. They're kind of a conveyance rain garden system. There's two types, really. There's a rain garden that just is static and it infiltrates, and that's really what it does. Your goal is not to have that water going anywhere. It goes there and infiltrates. But there's also a conveyance rain garden, and these ones at Seattle Sea Streets, if you go to Seattle Public Utilities website, you can see that on there and go down to Seattle and check those out. And they're very cool.
How does that differ in terms of
It's meant to convey the water, so it really is meant to not infiltrate everything. It has a slope to it, and it's really a swale. But it also has the compost-emitted soil, so any water that does stay in that soil can infiltrate. So your goal is that if you have, you know, 10 gallons at the beginning, your goal at the end is to have zero, but that typically doesn't happen. So you'll have maybe 3 gallons at the end, and you still need to deal with that.
And how do you control for erosion in that scenario?
Well, that, the vegetation is crucial, and you need to have that established in the bottom of the soil. So when that water is flowing, it's not just taking silt and debris with it. The vegetation is helping clean that out, and typically the swale slope is very, very light. So it's not flowing at a high rate. It's really kind of statically flowing through there very smoothly.
And I didn't see, speaking of silt, you had sandy soil and clay, but you didn't have silty soil.
Silty soil I would throw into the broad range of clay, which can be difficult to deal with as well. But yeah, there's a lot of different varieties of soil. I didn't address all of them here. But they can lie in those three broad categories. And silt, I'd throw it in the clay.
Do you have a preference between, you showed the open conveyance system with rock and gravel versus the pipe system? I mean, what are the advantages and disadvantages to that?
I think the conveyance system on the surface can be an advantage in a way, because what we just talked about, if you do have some infiltration happening on the way to the rain garden, that's great. But if your site may not be conducive to that, you may have to go subsurface. So I don't know if there's a huge advantage of one over the other. It's really just getting that water there and only bringing the water that you want to go there. That's kind of the main concern. But I would say if you had a choice, I'd go with the surface conveyance. It also could be an aesthetic value. If you saw some of those dry river beds, they can be pretty attractive as well.
Yeah, well, also my thought was architecturally it might be interesting if you had some sort of downspout system where it was actually a high-speed conveyance.
Yeah.
It looked like a fountain when it was,
yep,
you know, raining.
Well, you'll see that a lot in commercial and public applications of this, where they'll take that water and actually display it as they're bringing it to the rain garden, or even a cistern, a rainwater harvesting system.
Does it have any disadvantages? Like when it gets to the end, is it more likely to overflow because it comes in real fast?
No, as long as you've designed your system correctly, that amount of water has been planned for.
Okay.
So you should be able to accommodate that, unless you get your 500-year storm, which can cause some problems, but then your overflow's there, so you're all safe. Yes?
Are mosquitoes or algae a problem?
I'm glad you asked that. That's what I was thinking someone would ask. If you're designing it correctly, the rain garden is not meant to hold water for long periods of time. It's meant to infiltrate that water and get rid of it. So you should not have a mosquito problem unless you have improperly adjusted your infiltration rate of the soil, or something happened to change that infiltration rate. Because the water should sit there for just a period of time and start to dissipate. Mosquitoes need a longer time period for that to happen. So it really should not be a problem. It's all in the design and the planning and location done up front.
The typical design for this is for them to drain within 24 hours.
Yeah, that's,
it takes what, like 2 to 3 days for mosquitoes to hatch.
Yeah.
So it's draining, it's designed right, and it works properly. It's draining within 24 hours, you're not going to have mosquito problems.
Do you know if there are incentives to install them?
Not on a single-family residence level. If you're going to a commercial development or a large-scale residential development, as you know, platted homes, there is some kickback. If you're in King County, there's some incentives. Kirkland has some incentives for meeting a built green requirement, which is a star rating requirement, and doing stormwater management can help you meet that. And then the city of Kirkland, I believe, has some expedited permit review for that, I think. And then King County also has some incentives where they'll kick back money to a developer if they actually implement some of these things. Not on the individual homeowner level. It's more of a driver for aesthetics and the environmental quality of it. So I think those are really the motivating factors for doing it in a single family.
It would be really nice if there was some sort of something from the city where you paid less on your sewer bill, water, sewer, garbage. If you've got, you know, a certain amount coming in and even less going out.
Yeah, that's a good idea. That's something to consider.
That the person who talked to, right?
Yes.
Homeowners to disconnect their
The city of Portland has done that in particular locations because they're one of the cities that I mentioned that has a lot of combined sewer overflows. As a matter of fact, the picture where the guy was scraping out the rain garden, that particular rain garden was built specifically to treat combined sewer overflows in that area. They had one or two events a year. They built that rain garden, and it basically took a whole basin of a neighborhood into that rain garden. They haven't had one since. It was a 2-year study, so that hasn't. It's not very long term, but since they put it in, they haven't had any events of combined sewer overflow. So it's positive.
And the High Point community at Westdale has
them. That's right. That's another example. High Point has them all over the place in various different types, conveyance and static systems. Yes?
Yeah, can you use rain gardens to plant food plants like
berries? No, that's not recommended. Because of the rainwater going in there, you don't really know what kind of pollutants might get into that water. So it's not recommended to use it as a food source. Yes?
Do other countries use this system that have downpours?
Yeah. Yeah, this is fairly common in Europe. They also, with like green roofs, they've done that for a long time. They've been doing this type of system for a while as well.
What about tropical areas?
You know, I don't know much about that. That's something I'd have to look into. I couldn't answer that.
A swale, is that like a dry rock, a creek?
Yeah, a swale can be any surface conveyance water system.
So with like a dry rock stream, mm-hmm. away from your house, that not lead to more small insects, so to speak, living underneath the rocks, working their way closer to your house?
That's possible, yeah. I mean, I think, I don't know if you're going to have home-damaging insects that are going to be in that particular environment, but it's a possibility. I think, you know, you're probably talking about insects that would damage your home. Is that correct?
Well, I don't know. I woke up the other day after a mist or whatever, and it just looked like I was living in a haunted house.
All the spider webs, yeah. Yeah, well, rain gardens can't address spider issues at this point, no.
Spiders are good.
Yeah. Yes.
You mentioned the C streets, and that stands for SEA, meaning Street Edge Alternatives.
Yes.
All of you that live in Kirkland or maybe in other communities, if you think that we're going to be building sidewalks in your neighborhood for a length of the street, take a look at what the city does offer in these SEA streets, because it's nothing more than what we've been talking about here, extended along the sidewalk, mm-hmm. and they convey the water to the point where you don't need storm drains that eventually go down and empty into the lake.
That's right.
A lot of what Kirkland provides, the towns around Kirkland, Our call is to deliver water into the lake that's relatively clean.
Yes.
And so here's a great way of doing it, but it's different than what we generally construct in street edges, being the road, the curb, the gutter, and the sidewalk and a planter strip.
That's right.
We're just beginning to play with them. And if you have some time and you want to go over and walk right near the North Gate area.
Mm-hmm.
The SEA streets that come up from Piper Creek in Seattle, which would be near Greenwood and 103rd. And they've done a grid of about 8 to 10, 12 blocks or more. And so they have two types, the ones that go north and south, and mm-hmm. ones that go east and west, which are unique because they plummet down into Puget Sound and Piper Creek. And the idea that they were trying to solve is that stormwater without these systems takes the creek up like 3 or 4 feet in a major storm. The fish don't kind of like that. They didn't like that. It's not normal. The last major storm they had, the creek didn't really come up appreciably. So it's hard to get used to the fact that as in an urban environment that we have a meandering little path with a swale on both sides potentially is new, unique.
Yep.
But I think we could really get used to it.
Yeah, it definitely looks different than your traditional streetscape, but I would definitely encourage anybody who's interested in that to go look at it as well. I mean, it has, like I was talking about at the beginning of the presentation, it uses several different techniques of low-impact development, swales and rain gardens just being one of those. They've reduced the amount of pavement for the drive aisle. They've used pervious concrete in some of the applications for the sidewalk. So they're really doing all these different things in combination to help reduce the stormwater problem that happens in that area.
Interestingly, the neighborhood bought literally.
Yes, some of them did.
And now what you see over there is, first of all, they all love it because their basements are dry.
Yep.
Basement type houses, older houses. The neighborhood, you've seen a change in people fixing up their front yards and redoing their houses. They've brought a lot of pride to the neighborhood, they walk the street a lot because it's charming.
Yeah, it's silly. Attractive. I mean, the plant material has really taken hold, and I mean, it looks beautiful. So it's functioning, and it looks great, and I mean, it's really a good example of something that could be implemented more. Yes? Pervious concrete is basically concrete that water can flow through. So it's concrete that has open void spaces within it, so the water perks right through it instead of sheet running off of it.
It's a special kind that you buy before?
It's a special mix. I don't think it's available right now as to go buy like a ready mix and do it at your home. You'd have to get a contractor to do it. But it kind of has a look like Rice Krispie treats. It kind of looks like that. Yeah, and there actually is some examples. Is it Waverly Park right over here? What's the name of the new park right behind?
Heritage Park.
Yeah, Heritage Park. I believe there is some pervious concrete over there you could take a look at.
We have High Point as well.
Yeah, and High Point again. High Point in Seattle has almost all of these low-impact development techniques on display for you to take a look at.
And keep in mind, as citizens, low-impact development is a good thing, because it can save a lot of long-term capital costs. If once you get big enough that you need to put in utilities, it can cost everybody a significant amount of money.
June?
There's a development right off 132nd.
Peter Park.
It's just a new kind of an in.
Oh, okay.
They put it in at the main street going in.
Oh, on the street?
Right
on. Oh, that's interesting.
Right on the street when you come into the complex.
Okay.
And it's...
That's great. I mean, the street is one area where developers and engineers and landscape architects have been hesitant to use pervious concrete because they're not sure on the strength of it and if it can really handle the vehicular traffic loads that happen there. But in talking with Cadman and people there, and they're a major supplier of gravel and concrete in the area, as well as some people from the Concrete Council. They'll tell you that this can be just as strong depending upon the mix that you put in here, and it can actually meet some of the ratings of strength that high vehicle, like fire truck type lanes, need to meet. It's just a matter of convincing developers and engineers and the people designing it to get on board, and also the municipalities and their public works standards kind of don't really have that in it right now, so it's hard to get that permitted. But it's interesting. Did you guys get to see this over there? Let's see it.
I just wanted to add a little bit about the overflow. Mm-hmm. Kind of look at where you're going, and maybe you're keeping it 10 feet away from your foundation, but look where your neighbor's is. Because I'm in public works, and we'll get the phone call from the neighbor.
That's right.
If the water's directed there, or if it's not graded right, or something like that.
Yep.
And also, like the one that we're putting in at Forbes House, it's got a big park area, so we did not do any kind of a connection up to the public storm system or anything for the overflow. We're just going to have a rock overflow because it just drained to the park area.
Mm-hmm.
And that may work if you have a lot of space, or depending on where it's going, but just don't direct it towards your neighbor.
Yeah. Well, emphasis on safe location for overflow.
And that's the same with when you're doing typical building as well. Be careful when you're building that you're not pushing the water off into someone else's mm-hmm. property.
Yeah.
Because we'll get the phone call.
And if someone builds next to you and you all of a sudden have water issues in your yard, call the city.
Yep. If you have a location where your yard or your front yard blends with your neighbors, you know, this is a great opportunity to work with them, to have both of your downspouts go to the rain garden. It could be a neighborhood rain garden. You know, all of those things could work real well. They've also been used in the middle of traffic circles. That's an option and a municipal option to have a rain garden there as well, depending on how the water flows in that area. So,
I was just curious, as far as landscape matting on steeper slopes mm-hmm. near your rain garden, make sure the soil doesn't eventually...
Yeah, we definitely want to consider slopes. You don't want to locate these at the, you know, within 50 feet of the top of a steep slope or the bottom of a steep slope. So you're trying to keep those away to, you know, one of those is that reason. But mostly it's because you're infiltrating water in that area, and now you're just weakening the base of the slope or the top of the slope, and you can now cause a landslide hazard. So you need to consider that if you have a slope on your site.
And one more question on the... all the calculations,
yeah.
Area calculations I mentioned earlier.
Yep.
If you have an overflow, let's say a submerged an underground perforated pipe of sufficient length?
An underground perforated pipe is not an overflow. Let's make sure everybody understands that. An underground perforated pipe under your rain garden is not an overflow. That is going to collect that water that's going down. We're talking about water that's flowing up and flooding over the top because your infiltration rate isn't working fast enough. So if your pipe's down below there, it's not going to be able to convey that water either. You may have a problem in the soil. It might not even get to that pipe. You also have some static pressures going on, some hydrostatic pressures in there that are going to cause some interesting things in that pipe to happen. So that's not an overflow. But you can't just design the rain garden and say, hey, I got an overflow, it's fine. That's not how it works. You can do that if you know you have a downstream source that can handle whatever volume's coming out of there, but you need to make sure that that's there. But the point of the rain garden is to infiltrate. So if you do it that way, you basically just erase the whole point of the rain garden. Because now you're not functioning the way you're really trying to function, which is infiltrate the water on site.
In my case, I plan on putting in like a 30, 35 foot long stream.
Mm-hmm.
Regenerated with a pump.
Sure.
Keep going. Heavy rains or storms here would cause that to overflow.
Mm-hmm.
So I was planning at the end of the pond, having a footbridge.
Yep.
Where the water overflow underneath the footbridge into a rain garden.
Okay.
Down the hill from the
sure.
stream.
That could work. Yeah. That sounds logical. Yeah.
Could it all, a rain garden also be used in a supplementary kind of way to your rain barrel? If you wanted to use
oh, yeah.
barrel for summer,
mm-hmm.
the overflow pipe and angle
yep.
up for mm-hmm. winter.
Right? Yeah, I think that's a great application. Yeah, you're combining two different low impact development techniques, so that's good.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
I got a couple copies of these if anybody's interested. There you go.
Thank you for filling out the questionnaire.
Thanks.
So we can do this better next time.
There you go.
And
there you go.
Thank you all for coming.
Got one left. Anybody?